Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, November 1st, 2018. Friends of two SPLM-IO officials abducted by South Sudanese authorities want to know when they will be freed.
National security and other security organs in the country, and some of them told me that they had seen the two. I'm not sure whether they were telling the truth or not, but I had no reason to doubt what they told me.
And 15 people were killed during a deadly cattle raids in Jongla State.
Those who are in critical condition now, we are referring four of them to Juba for further treatment. Okay, the first patient, we got the lady. Okay, I don't want to mention the names.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, Riek Machar, has fired his shadow governor for Yei River State. South Sudan in Focus viewed a letter in which Machar suspended SPLM-IO Governor General Matata Frank for appearing in a video documentary entitled The Profiteers by a Kenyan investigative journalist, John Alan Namu. The film looks into corruption in South Sudan. Machar's letter revoked Frank's impunity and ordered him to appear before a SPLM-IO investigation committee. SPLM-IO deputy military spokesman Colonel Paul Lam Gabriel, who also featured in the documentary, discusses how he can facilitate truckloads of timber from South Sudan through Uganda border. Lam later recorded a video of himself on Facebook denying his involvement in any illegal timber business in South Sudan. Machar has instructed SPLM-IO Deputy Shadow Governor of Yei River State to carry on Frank's duties. Relatives and friends of Dong Samuel and Agri Idri are asking the South Sudan government to release the two SPLM-IO officials who were abducted in January 2017 in Nairobi by men believed to be South Sudan security operatives. President Salva Kiir pardoned two prisoners on Wednesday as a gesture of his goodwill, but David Mayen Dengdit, a former press officer in the office of South Sudan's vice president, says Dong Samuel and Agri Idri should also be released. Mayen says he believes the two SPLM-IO officials are languishing in one of South Sudan's secret detention centers.
You know, when I was in Juba, I was concerned about their whereabouts. And I actually asked some of my former colleagues in the SPLA who are senior officers in national security and other security organs in the country, and some of them told me that they had seen the two. I'm not sure whether they were telling the truth or not, but I had no reason to doubt what they told me in Juba, and I hope that the two are still alive and they get their lives back again.
Yesterday, President Kiir said he's going to give directives to security operatives to see if there are other prisoners there. And you're saying here that you're worried if they're alive. I mean, what could have happened? It's very strange that these two people disappeared from Nairobi and all of a sudden people are saying we don't know where they are, and the government of South Sudan is not even concerned. The rebels are saying they don't know where they are. So where could these two individuals be?
Let me try to answer by way of putting the whole thing in its rightful context. You know, tragedy of historically unprecedented proportion has stricken the country, and an epidemic of human rights violations has taken hold of the country. And we have seen so many advocates extrajudicially disappeared, killed, or imprisoned. The fact that the president does not even know whether they are more prisoners or not indicate that there is a serious disconnect in the country between those who are supposedly in charge of the country and those who operate on the streets of the country and in the region.
And so in a situation like this where you are getting a statement from the highest office saying, I don't know whether there are still prisoners there. Now, this is what has been happening. One day, the officials would say, the authorities in South Sudan would say, we don't have prisoners. And then the next day, the president issues a decree releasing prisoners. So we are getting messages from both sides of the mouth. Who should we believe here?
It's very unfortunate, John, that we no longer believe anybody. We just want to see tangible commitments to ceasefire, to respect of human rights, and we the people of South Sudan no longer believe any verbal commitments from their leaders or misleaders, as it were. And it's a tragedy. It's really a tragedy that these young or middle-aged South Sudanese intellectual and someone like Dong Samuel was employing and training lawyers through his law firm in South Sudan, and he was so much committed to seeing that the legal fraternity in South Sudan grows, and to disappear himself through extrajudicial abductions and killings. It's just disappointing. We have now underground prisons in Juba. So many people attested to that.
Your government position in Juba was quite sensitive. You were the press officer of the vice president of the country. One of your jobs as a public affairs officer is to inform the public. But what is happening in South Sudan is the information we get from public affairs officers are not accurate. Sometimes they even contradict their leaders. What is going on?
Well, it's sad that public affairs officers or media personnel in the country are either intimidated or just outright ignorant of what is happening beneath the scene. Some of them are sycophants of the regime, and they are so much committed to their stomachs rather than to the people of South Sudan.
That's David Mayen Dengdit, former press officer in the office of South Sudan's vice president. He was speaking with me from Denver, Colorado, earlier today. Jonglei State authorities say more than a dozen people, including women and children, were killed and dozens of others wounded in two separate attacks this week. Jonglei State Deputy Governor says cattle raiders suspected of being from neighboring Boma State raided villages in Duk, Payual, and Bor North counties. Dengai Deng has the story for VOA from Bor.
Officials say 15 people were killed and more than 2,000 head of cattle were stolen. Agon Deng says her 3-year-old son was killed in the attack. Speaking in Dinka, Deng, who was shot in her right breast, says the raiders stormed the camp in the middle of the night while she and her 5 children were asleep.
The attackers came from the western part of the camp and passed through the camp to the east. They shot at us and kept shooting until they left us at the camp. I did not run anywhere. They were shooting and cutting ropes from the cattle and then left.
A 13-year-old girl named Achul suffered an injury to her right leg during the attack and is hospitalized at Bor Civil Hospital. Speaking in Dinka, Achul says she and her siblings were asleep when the gunmen attacked Jalepayam's Akut cattle camp in Bor North County.
I was sleeping when they came and surrounded the cattle camp and started shooting randomly. I then woke up when the sound of gunfire became louder and they shot me. We ran with the injury to the bush and hid there until morning.
Bor Civil Hospital Director Dr. Moses Gak says his staff is treating 7 people injured in the attack.
Those who are in critical condition now, we are referring 4 of them to Juba for further treatment. Okay, the first patient, we got a lady. Okay, I don't want to mention the names. was the lady who was shot at the chest, and the baby, I think she was carrying the baby was killed instantly, but she still sustained the injury on the chest. So she's one of the patients now we are referring to Juba. She's stable, but we wanted, because of lack of specialties, doctors, and medicine.
Jonglei State Deputy Governor Agon Alier confirms armed men attacked Dukpa UL County on Tuesday, killing 5 people, and he says the same men attacked Kutin Bor North County, killing another 10 people early yesterday morning.
That was exactly the day the people of South Sudan were celebrating peace in Juba. Then the area of Jale experienced a barbaric attack from the cattle raiders and child abductors, most probably from the neighboring state of Buma. And before it, that was exactly on the 30th. Again, there was an attack in the area of Poktap in Dukpa UL County, where a number of lives were lost.
Alier urges the families of the victims and the communities of Jonglei State to remain peaceful despite the deadly attack.
The whole population and the affected families, we are believers in God, so we are urging them, those who have lost their loved one, for condolences to them. Those whom are witnessing here with their sons and daughters injured, we are urging them to be in peace.
But Alier has his message for national leaders.
Check some of the wrong elements, who tried to get benefits out of the sufferings of their people. The national government should focus on these wrong type of politicians or these wrong type of intellectuals who try always to incite violence among communities as a means of they surviving politically.
Alier says he believes some of the people behind the attack could be politicians who use area youth to gain political capital. Margaret Gola, the Burma State Information Minister, says Burma officials have no knowledge of the attack. But speaking by phone from Pibor, Gola says Burma officials are investigating the matter and will bring the perpetrators to justice if they are found to be from Burma.
We do not have anything about what happened in Burma.
After touring 5 states carved out of Jonglei State early this year, First Vice President Tavan Dengai warned governors, county commissioners, and Fayam chiefs that unless they prevent their people from carrying out cattle raids and child abductions, the national government will hold them accountable. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng, reporting from Bor.
A new book makes a case that countries peace builders might have to break a few norms and accountability structures to meet the goals and expectations of peace building. As Ayen Dengbio reports, the author says a crucial step is determining who peace builders are accountable to.
In her new book, Susanna Campbell, assistant professor of the School of International Service at American University, looks at the fail rate of peacebuilding organizations.
International peacebuilding organizations are actually designed to fail at peacebuilding because they are accountable to global, not local actors. Organizations respond to the preferences of the people and individuals and entities to whom they are accountable. International peacebuilding aims to change the behavior of local actors, not global actors.
The book is called Global Governance and Local Peace, Accountability and Performance in International Peacebuilding. And in it, Campbell makes the case that organizations have to make themselves accountable to local stakeholders, even if that means bypassing standard operating procedures that make them accountable to headquarters. Staff on the ground may have to break a few rules to create impact, she argues.
This has several important implications for peacebuilding policy and practice. The first one is that the solution is not more top-down accountability, right? So you can't solve this problem of peacebuilding performance by forcing country offices to be more accountable to headquarters for what they're doing. That actually has a perverse effect. The solution is to actually empower innovation in country office staff and give them time to listen and learn from diverse local stakeholders.
There are cases where peace building succeeds, but in cases where peace building is struggling, Campbell says peace builders must look to local stakeholders. Mike Jobbins, Senior Director of Partnerships and Engagement at the Search for Common Ground, says organizations need to take a second look at peace building infrastructure.
More often than not, it's despite rather than because of how the system is set up and incentivized. At Search, our approach is to always first to begin by choosing hope. Identifying, if you look in Burundi, for example, it's very easy back in 2003, 2002, to come up with the lists of things that were impossible. And frankly, an awful lot of embassy cables, an awful lot of UN reports were spent entirely itemizing everything that Burundi didn't have then and every reason every peace agreement would fail.
Campbell says creating local accountability requires innovation and also requires staff to spend time with local communities. Ayen Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, traders in South Sudan say they will not reduce the prices of food. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what are the most successful means to fight corruption?
The most successful means to fight corruption is to punish those who go against the law.
Well, the most successful means to fight corruption, I would say, is one, that the civil servants that are the engine room of government should be well motivated. At that angle, you now start to fight it within.
If everybody had access to a minimum wage and maybe they were content with the salaries that they're getting, probably that would help.
We fight it from the grassroots, from below, by teaching it in schools, children, that there's a need not to be corrupt. If we do that, when they get to the position of leaders, they are not going to be corrupt too.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Some traders in Juba say even though the government signed a peace deal with opposition groups last month in Ethiopia, prices of essential commodities will remain high unless the deal is fully implemented. Winnie Chirino has the details for VOA from Juba.
Traders say even though thousands of people participated in celebrations marking the signing of the revitalized peace agreement, the cost of living is likely to remain high. James Yugu, a trader in Juba's customs market, says many people cannot even afford items that cost 10 South Sudanese pounds. Speaking in Arabic, Yugo says the five-year civil war is mainly to blame for the country's extremely high commodity prices and drop in value of the South Sudanese pound.
If this peace agreement is implemented correctly, then it will affect the exchange rate of the local currency against hard currency, and the dollar will depreciate against pound. And if that happens, then the prices for everything in the market will reduce.
Tassalamu Baraka, a Sudanese trader in Juba's customs market, says he is relieved South Sudan's leaders are working to restore peace and stability across the country. Speaking in Arabic, he says he too believes if peace prevails, commodity prices will drop.
For example, I as a trader, I would like to see the prices reducing to how they used to be when the dollar rate was good, so that everyone can buy what they want. And this is my message to people out there, and I hope this peace is enjoyed by all.
Butcher Joseph Kamis says prices of food items, including meat, will slowly fall as peace and security begin to take hold in the country. Speaking in Arabic, he says months ago a kilogram of meat was selling for 1,200 South Sudanese pounds, but dropped to 1,100 pounds in the past few days.
Nothing is produced locally here. Even the meat we are selling is not from here. But now if there is peace and stability, all this will reduce because all the roads like Por, Terekeka, Maridi, Yei will be open. But if there is no peace, the prices will be high.
Grace Adia sells maize, cassava and millet next to a grinding mill in customs market. Adia says a big barrel of maize sells at 1,000 South Sudanese pounds. Speaking in Arabic, Adia says she hopes the conflict will end once and for all so that families can once again produce their own food. Adia says if peace comes, everyone will go to cultivate in their villages because it is the conflict that is preventing people from doing that. But otherwise, Adia says people want to move freely, but the roads are not safe. Adia says while traders sympathize with people who cannot afford essential commodities like food, traders are still being forced to import goods at high prices from neighboring countries like Uganda and Kenya. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Kampala, where Uganda has lost billions of dollars in recent years from illegal financial flows, including tax evasion, crime, and corruption. Uganda's Financial Intelligence Authority, set up to track illicit money, says it lacks resources to stem the flow. Halima Athomani reports from Kampala.
Tax evasion, money laundering, and related corruption are costing Uganda at least $1 billion a year, according to Global Financial Integrity. The Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit said in a September report that tax evasion from imports and exports alone cost Uganda $6.7 billion from 2006 to 2015. Nearly $3 billion more was lost to errors and omissions in balance of payments over the last decade. Global Financial Integrity says the economic losses were worsened by Uganda's role as a haven for illegal funds from its war-torn neighbors such as South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, and Kenya. Ezra Munyambonera is lead researcher at Uganda's Economic Policy Research Center and helped write the report. He blames Uganda's under-regulated financial system.
Whether you have got money from selling human beings, even buying goods and services. So that's one way we had the war, ADF war. It was in DRC. But how was the money getting out? The same thing with Sudan. Sudan people come here with dollars. They have come in high profile. But nobody will ask them, where is the source of this money?
The Economic Policy Research Center's Paul Lakuma, who also contributed to the report, is more blunt. He says leaders in Uganda ignore the illegal money.
Our political leaders, do they have the will of fighting it or they are benefiting from it? Maybe it serves their political interests, like maybe stability or the length in which they stay in power. So they will look the other way.
Uganda's Financial Intelligence Authority is mandated to check illegal financial flows in the country. Its director, Sydney Asubo, says a lack of collaboration and coordination between government departments has hindered efforts to stop the flow. He says the agency's resources and authority are also limited.
If we know people evading tax, if it's to do with gold smuggling or cash smuggling, we inform the relevant bodies. If it's to do with terrorism financing, we inform the counter-terrorism police. So it's not because the officer doesn't know what to do, but the main challenge we have is funding.
Despite the billions in lost revenue, Global Financial Integrity notes Uganda has made progress against money laundering and cutting off some terrorist financing. Uganda passed a 2013 Anti-Money Laundering Act, which requires disclosure of transactions of $26,500 or more. But corruption and enforcement are still a problem, says the Uganda Financial Intelligence Authority's Asubo. Since starting its operation against illegal money in 2015, Asubo says they have had only two court convictions. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Some young South Sudanese entrepreneurs are introducing local fashions to diversify communities across the country. The second edition of Nile Couture Fashion Show was held last weekend in Juba, and local designers were front and center. Some models who took part in the show says the event brings together different communities and promotes peaceful coexistence. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
South Sudanese singer Sarah Cipriano entertained the audience as models strutted down the runway to showcase the work of various designers at Logale House in Juba. Doris Keji, the founder of Nile Couture Fashion Show, says she's promoting locally made designs using African print known as kitenga for men and women in hopes that people will stop depending on foreign clothes. She says the civil war has hurt the local fashion industry.
If we have peace, there will be stability. We will have more, people will turn to
think about, other than thinking about other problems like hunger, sickness, whatever, we do start thinking about things like, okay, fashion, I want to dress up, I want to do these things, so life will be good.
KG is encouraging young South Sudanese to think about specializing in fashion designs as part of the national effort to develop the country. South Sudanese designer Winnie Raymond says she is thrilled that fellow South Sudanese appreciated her designs in the show. Raymond hopes one day her designs will be appreciated overseas.
I'm seeing myself like in the next near future or in future that my collection is going to be in New York, in Paris Fashion Week, New York Fashion Week, all over the world, international, not just so. I hope for the best, and I'm going to work on that.
Most of the 20 South Sudanese models in the show say they were happy to be part of the event that showcased local designers. 25-year-old male model Maur Lino says he was in the show to challenge the myth that modeling is reserved for women only. Lino says fashion shows can help change the image of South Sudan, which is often associated with war and food insecurity.
There are several ways of building up the country. It's not only by physical building like infrastructure and that kind of thing. Also modeling industries, we can build them up, show our culture like the way we're doing today. It's not that we need to focus always on white or Western culture. So we need to focus on our culture sometime also.
Some of those who attended the show say they were inspired by local designers. 23-year-old Helen Mangar says she hopes to become a fashion model and inspiring young South Sudanese girls. Mangar says she learned from interacting with some of the models that they hail from many different communities.
And once we get together and know each other and talk with each other, we learn that everybody else is just like you and you can actually get to interact with them. And therefore, that is promoting peace. If other people see you communicating with each other and socializing with each other, that brings peace.
27-year-old Juba resident Emma Jigi called the show as amazing. Jigi says she ended up going home with two blouses made by local designers.
It was beyond my expectations. The designs, I mean, that were designed were amazing. The models, the setup, and of course, definitely the location.
KG and Raymond say they plan to organize more fashion shows, which they hope will inspire more young South Sudanese to join the fashion industry. For VOA News, I am Michael Latit in Juba.
That story about fashion show from Juba brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Lotole by WJ.
Baby Juba, scissor rap in H.A. Washington, W.J. is so Juba-rific.
Washington.
Don't cry no more. Baby Juba. Baby Juba, don't cry no more. Osili empenzu wangu. Don't cry no more. Baby Juba. Baby Juba, don't cry no more. Osili empenzu wangu. Baby Juba.
Iya kanya ta dunia de akitopi. Kani tabishilu aga wat. Mwele tabika tulu zol ya sabikele ayu. Itabukura biliko taki. Ana bukura biliko.
We have been listening to WJ with the song Lotole. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us. Let us know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is @VOA South Sudan. If you are planning to get out of Juba where there are no VOA FM stations, you can listen to this show on shortwave. Our frequencies are 11850 kilohertz, 13865 kilohertz, and 15180 kilohertz. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.